Oh, Tommy.
Here with the gravy, Davey.
Davey.
Everybody eats when they come to my house. Have a tomato, Plato.
Plato.
Here's got your Toradora.
Oh, Dora.
Try the bologna, Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Everybody welcome to Say house. Yes to the Chef. Our guests today are Dr. Charles Sidnor of Rayburn Farm and Ross Flynn of Left Bank Butchery. I'm Chef Janice Escott. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, I'm Chef Kelly Taylor.
And hello to you both.
Hello.
Glad to have you both here today. We have lots of interesting things to talk about. And let's just sort of start with Charlie. Tell us about Rayburn Farm.
Rayburn Farm was originated in 1975. It was added to a number of times over the ensuing 30-some years, so that it is now about 500 acres in southern Alamance County, dedicated to the training of dressage horses by my wife and to raising of beef cattle by me.
How did you get into raising beef cattle?
Part of my life, I was raised on a ranch up on the Montana-Idaho border, have always been interested in ranching. And as a matter of fact, I had the choice when I was 21 of either going back and running the ranch or going to medical school, and I ended up doing both.
How do you do both? How do you go to medical school and run a ranch?
Well, I didn't run the ranch,
okay.
but I mean, once I came back to the beef industry, I've just always enjoyed raising cattle.
And you still are doing it. 500 acres seems like a pretty large chunk of land. I don't know that much about raising cattle. How much land is optimal for raising cattle?
It depends on where you live. In Montana, where I grew up, it would be 30 to 40 acres for a cow.
Oh, per cow.
In North Carolina, it's about 2 to 3 acres per cow because of the rainfall. Where I lived in Montana was 8 to 12 inches of rain. In North Carolina, we have 47 inches of rain. It makes a huge difference in terms of the production of grass. So we can raise many more animals on an acre here than we can elsewhere. And it would be even lower in, say, Nevada.
So all of your cattle are they're just grass-fed? Because there's lots of ways to raise cattle,
yes,
obviously.
Yes, there are. And all of my cows are... They're born on the place. They live there until the last day in which they're taken to a USDA-inspected facility. Mm-hmm. And from there, they go to Ross. and so they're born there and stay there until the last day. And they are totally grass-fed.
So Ross, then,
yes.
How did you two meet? Brought Ross and who wins to talk? It doesn't matter to me. But how did we get to this relationship?
He's still wondering how I showed up. 8 years ago, I came down. I knew I was friends with his daughter, and I just came to visit. And actually, when I left New York City, and once I got to the farm, was really when the economy. Nobody knew what was up. Bear Stearns.
Or down.
down, yeah.
Yes.
Bear Stearns had
yes.
just happened. And it was that moment where nobody was going anywhere. No one was hiring anybody. And you really didn't know what kind of economy was in front of you. And I'd been working maybe 2 weeks on the farm, just helping out. And long story short was that working on the farm seemed to make a whole lot more sense than the mortgage-backed derivatives or whatever else was tanking our economy. So I just kind of hung out for a while. But like I said, that was 8 years ago and haven't left. But I did move into a different role, which I think helps the farm. So I've started up Left Bank Butchery along with my partner, Aaron Woolman. And we buy nearly all of Charles' cows. We're a whole animal butchery located in Saxball, North Carolina, and we now buy all of his cows and take it from there.
How many cows are we talking about?
I am in the middle of calving right now. I've got 22 babies on the ground, and by the time we finish, I'll have about 90. And so those 90 animals will stay until they are at least 2 years old, if not two and a half, and growing the animals to finish on grass is much slower than if I used grain.
So that's a two-year process, you mean? I don't know. What is a, I guess, what is the opposite called? Conventional farming, where it's on grain and then the, sometimes finished on grass, sometimes not?
Sure. The average, let's take the average calf born in Alamance County. It'll stay on the farm until it's weaned. And then one day the farmer needs some money, so he loads the animal up, takes it to Salis City. It's sold, goes to a backgrounding place, usually, say, Indiana. Stays there until it weighs about 700 pounds, gets on a truck, goes to Garden City, Kansas, where it goes into the feedlot, and it stays there until it weighs about 1,200 to 1,500 pounds. And then it gets on another truck and goes to, say, Montford, Colorado, where it's killed along with 6,000 other animals that day. It's then put on a truck and sent all over the country, and eventually that calf may end up coming back to North Carolina.
In the form of meat.
In the form of boxed beef is what it's called. And the animal will have traveled on average 2,500 miles to get to the to your plate.
Very interesting fact.
That's a well-traveled cow.
And so with this relationship with Ross, that doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't
happen.
Not
the traveling part.
That's what I mean. The traveling part doesn't happen.
The actual travel is about 30 miles because I take the animal has to go through a USDA inspected facility or Ross can't sell it, nor can I. I can sell the animal live to you, but I can't sell the product to you unless it's been inspected by USDA. So I take the animal on a truck. We took two yesterday. And we take them to Chaudhry Halal Meats in Siler City, and the animal is slaughtered there, and then they are transported tomorrow. In 2 days, they're transported to Ross in the form of primals, meaning that they don't just take the whole carcass and deliver it. They cut it into pieces, and that's delivered to Ross, and he then is the butcher. He's the one that fabricates all the cuts and the grind and all that.
I would imagine, because a typical cow weighed how much?
Cow yesterday, the one I took for him, weighed 1,245 pounds, and that animal cut 724 pounds on the hook, meaning that the carcass weighed 724 pounds, and about 65% or maybe a little more of that will be everything from hamburger to steaks to soup bones.
So you've got then 700 pounds of animal.
Yep.
I mean, that's like a lot. I can't even imagine how you pick up 700 pounds of animal to begin your job.
What? It will come in as quarters, but trust me, those quarters are still heavy enough. But yeah, it's a bit of a puzzle then the rest of the week or 2 weeks as to how we want to break down that cow. And that has to do with what time of year it is, different qualities of the carcass itself. But people cook differently throughout the year, as you know. What somebody wants in July is different than what somebody wants in January.
Right, because people want to barbecue in July, and they want to roast it slowly or braise it or something in the winter, right?
Exactly, and the animals are not courteous enough to change their muscle makeup, so...
They're not courteous enough. They're courteous, huh?
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's the challenge that we do every week. What we do is called seam butchery, which is a term that refers to the seam between two muscles. So if you go to a grocery store, you might get a choice of filet mignon, ribeye, New York strip, and ground beef. And maybe you get a chuck roast thrown in there.
Well, before we talk about the chuck roast and the difference, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef on WCHL 97.9. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef. My name is Kelly Taylor with my co-host Janice Escott. Our guests today are Dr. Charles Sidnor, or Charlie as we're referring to him today, and Ross Flynn. Dr. Charlie Sidnor, or Charlie, is from Braeburn Farm, and Ross is from Left Bank Butchery. And before we left off, we were just starting to talk about the process. So we've got our cows from the farm, and they've been slaughtered, and now we're heaving giant heavy pieces of that same cow to Ross at Left Bank Butchery, and he was talking a little bit about his process, which he called seam butchery. So can you please explain what you mean? Because that obviously sets you apart from other butchers.
Right. Well, I should preface it by saying that the real reason that we deal with whole animal butchery, more than our commitment to utilizing the whole animal or the advantages, I believe, of seam butchery, is because that's what Charles raises. He raises whole animals. And so most butcher shops are really more meat markets. They buy boxed meat.
And what do you mean by that, boxed meat?
Well, let's say you sell a lot of sirloin steaks. You go and you order more sirloin steaks, and a bunch of sirloins show up in a box. You don't know what cow exactly that came from. You don't really know anything about that except for you have more sirloins in a box. That's certainly easier in some ways. But our number one reason that we are a whole animal butchery is because that's what Charles raises. And Cane Creek, where we buy all of our pigs, that's what Eliza raises. She raises animals, not boxes of primals.
Well, and besides, what happens if you order? What happens to the rest of the cow? So if someone's only ordering all sirloin or all, because there's several cuts of meat that everybody is used to buying at the butcher or the grocery store, and then there's a whole other animal.
So that's where the rest of the cow gets shipped even further than the 2,500 miles, because sometimes it gets sent over to somewhere in Asia where a cut is popular. And so on this very, very large scale, I guess it makes sense if you don't account for, of course, any of the externalities involved with shipping things all over the world. We keep it a little simpler. Cane Creek is literally across the street from the butcher shop. There's a pasture actually over there where Charles sometimes grazes as well. We can walk to most of our animals. They raise animals. We commit to buying the whole animal, which is what they want to do, and they can go back to farming. So, besides the advantages, I think, from a culinary sense of seam butchery, first and foremost, we do that because that's what we're dealing with, our animals, not boxes of meat. So.
Well, I imagine, Charlie, having someone committing ahead of time that they're going to buy your animals is advantageous.
It's very advantageous because in the past, I worked with Eliza McLean, who has Cane Creek Farm, and we would sell ribeyes to one restaurant and something else to another restaurant. And Ross is absolutely correct. Some of these restaurants would come in and say, "I want a case of ribeyes." Well, if I got them a case of ribeyes, it'd be like, I don't know how many cows that would be, 20 cows to get a case of ribeyes, and then I got the rest of 20 cows to deal with. I just found that dealing in with individual restaurants was difficult, and I committed some years ago to only dealing in whole animals. So I do sell occasional cow to Company Shops Market, the co-op grocery store in Burlington, but they literally buy the whole cow and take all the cuts and they sell them. And
but they don't butcher them.
No, I take that to a different.
Okay.
Take it to Piedmont Custom Meats, and it is cut to their specifications and frozen and taken to them, but. Always ideal in whole cows. It's possible for an individual to call me and want to buy a whole cow, and sometimes that happens, but not very often.
But that's for an individual, that's a lot.
End up being 450 pounds for an individual, and usually what that is that it's a family that buys it, so you've got multiple families related to one another who buy a cow.
And then share the expense and share a place to put it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean,
you're going to have a lot of freezer space.
It takes a big freezer to to hold 450 pounds of meat.
And so, you know, I used to work for Charles, and in our system then, we would take in a cow, you'd pay a large processing fee. It would be significant. So not only has this cow been 9 months in its mother's womb, it then spent 2.5 years on pasture, and then you take it to a processor, pay a huge bill then try and take it to a farmer's market, and you wind up putting 90%, 95% of the cow back into your freezer, hoping to sell it later.
Mm.
And the cash flow problem for the farm is brutal, and it is for all farmers with that system. And so this new system that we've worked towards is Charles takes the cow to the processor. They deliver it. I write him a check on the day it gets delivered. He goes back to farming.
Mm.
There's nothing to put in the freezer. You don't have to sit there and hope that some chef calls you and says, hey, can I get all your beef shanks? This is what we used to hope for. And it allows Charles and Eliza to go back to doing what I think they should be doing, which is farming.
No, it's a good partnership, a really good partnership that just came out sort of organically because you were working together on the farm.
So, Ross, how did you learn how to do this? He's thinking about it.
Yeah. It took a lot of years, but, you know, it started with me working at the farm and understanding all the cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to understand all those cuts to sell them directly to customers. And then trying my hand at starting to break things down. And, of course, you start with pigs. They're a whole lot easier to manage than the 700-pound cow that
because
comes in the door.
Because they're smaller,
okay. Yeah. And you can't really screw up too much, mm-hmm, with pork. You can always make sausage. So nobody's ever upset with extra sausage.
Not around here.
No, not in North Carolina.
No.
But anyway, moved on then to the beef. But there's a lot of resources out there, and I picked a lot of people's brains, so...
Okay, so it's sort of a self-learning kind of thing, by learn by doing.
Yeah,
a lot of us in the kitchen
learn by
we
doing.
Know about that.
Mm-hmm. That's how you doing. Learn. So we got a little off, but we still don't know what seam butchery is. So tell us what that is.
So seam butchery is, again, refers to the seam between two muscles.
An imaginary seam or a real seam?
A real seam between two muscles, as in those two muscles that are right beside each other do different things for the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can figure out what that muscle does for the animal, which sometimes you can make generalizations about and sometimes you're surprised and are wrong, but if you can figure out what that muscle does for the animal, you can figure out then what its qualities are going to be.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so... the chuck just refers to the shoulder of a cow, okay? When you see a chuck roast, it's normally a square, right?
Yes.
And they took it on a bandsaw and they just...
You mean it's not square on an animal?
It's only square with a bandsaw. And so what you wind up having is a lot of different muscles. And some of those muscles are tough and some of them are actually tender. But you kind of have to cook to the... lowest common denominator. I don't know how to word that.
The toughest muscle in the shoulder.
If you have something tough in that roast, you have to assume that the whole thing is tough. So it goes into your crock pot. Well, I like braising, and everyone likes braising, and that's okay. But the problem is that there were some tender muscles in there that if you had pulled out, would have been lovely on a grill.
Mm-hmm.
And, the rule of thumb – it's not even a rule of thumb. The rule about how meat is priced in America – is that it is priced entirely on how tender something is, entirely.
Mm-hmm.
The more complex way of wording that is it's priced according to how long it takes to become tender, because as anybody who has a crock pot knows, you can make anything tender. It just takes a while.
All right, we have to take another break, but we're just getting to the good stuff. I'm trying to understand. This is Say Yes to the Chef. We have to take a real quick break. You're listening to our guests today from Braeburn Farm and from Left Bank Butchery. Don't go anywhere. This is Say Yes to the Chef. Our guests today are Dr. Charlie Sidnor of Braeburn Farm and Ross Flynn of Left Bank Butchery. My name is Kelly Taylor with my co-host Janice Escott. And when we left off, we were talking with Ross about theme butchery and in particular how meats are priced. And I know that the meat that every beef cuts that everyone really does long for are the tender, juicy ones, which is what you were saying, how it's priced in America. But even more than that, there's the whole idea of marbling and what Americans think of as a high-quality piece of beef, even though you're smiling. So obviously, you believe there's a different way that meat should be priced than how it is currently being priced.
Yeah. You know, people ask me my favorite cut. That's like my most common question when somebody comes into the shop. And,
right.
You know, there are advantages. I love to braise. I love to grill. My favorite thing to do is to roast a big cut of beef. But, you know, it's about isolating the muscles and figuring out which ones are the best for what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, you know, there are only New York strips, ribeyes, and filet mignons that are worth putting on a grill is not true. When you come into our shop, you will see steaks that you have never heard of in your life. And that's okay. I mean, it doesn't take special instructions. But if there are many steaks on a cow that are tender enough to throw on a grill, and the flavor is going to be great. Most processors, it's not worth it to pull out these muscles.
That's what I was going to ask. Where did these cuts go normally? Where did they go in the rest of the cows that are being processed?
Well, they've, you know, obviously run enough numbers and figured out that it's worth leaving some of those tender cuts within that chuck roast. And maybe it is, but, you know, I guess the reason we wanted to start this shop, you know, we love to make charcuterie and we really wanted to cut well. And if somebody spends 2.5 years, I think raising some of the best grass-fed beef, you know, anywhere around, you know, I think it's my job to do the animal justice, and that's by pulling out those individual muscles. Sometimes I'll pull out a muscle, you know, a petite tender, for example. There is less than 1 pound on an entire side of an animal. It's still worth pulling out. I don't know. You can tell me that financially maybe it's not, but I just think that it is.
A lot of respect back to the farmer and to the animal itself.
And I think, you know, as we talk about how do we make this food affordable, you know, I try and make it affordable. People can come in and they only look at the ribeyes, and our ribeyes are cheaper than any other place that buys the quality of beef that we buy. But we also make it even more affordable by pulling out these cuts that you've never heard of and saying, this is going to work a lot like a sirloin steak. This mm-hmm. is going to be a lot like a New York strip steak, and giving people these other options to where most of our steaks are really $4 to $6 a piece. And when people see that, they go, oh, actually, that's not that expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, everybody's on a different budget, but so long as burgers at Burger King can cost $6, then our steaks can cost $6.
Well, I do think that might be something that people are not normally used to, going to the butcher, because the butcher's kind of lost what the butcher once was, right? We used to go to the butcher and ask for their expertise.
It is, and most of it's packaged. So you have to just look at the package and figure it out for yourself most of the time. And then even when you ask, it's pretty vague.
And that's the number one thing I want people to walk out of the shop with is confidence, and that's what we can actually communicate. That's what we can do that even a big grocery chain can't do, is to, you know, we have tons of books in there. I print out recipes for people. I send them out with something in a back that's going to help make that roast wonderful. I feel like if I can send people out of the shop without the stress that normally goes along with cooking and with meat, and especially with good meat.
Because mm-hmm. you don't want to ruin it.
You don't want to ruin it. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. if I can walk mm-hmm. somebody out of there to where they can actually enjoy cooking for their friends and family, honestly, I just think they'll come back to my shop. I think
they
it's
will.
Good business.
That's good business. It makes sense for everyone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Charlie, you had a great story earlier that you were mentioning I think you should tell.
Well, The average person who goes to buy beef has no concept of the totality of the cow. And I had a lady who once called me and said, I'd like a cow. And I said, well, that's great. How would you like it processed? Because I have to take it to the processor, and they'll cut it into the various cuts. And she says, don't worry. It's very simple. I want it all cut in ribeyes. And Ross and I have always said we're really looking for that cow because she's really valuable. But this is one of the things I always tell people if they come and tell me they want a whole cow, I ask them to go to Ross's shop and buy some cuts of meat and look at what they might really want. And I tell them you will not get this level of expertise from a commercial fabricating plant. You just can't do it. They're not set up to do what Ross does. And so I'm delighted because there's a whole nother world that I live in of ecology and other things that the cow is part of. And once I have raised the animal to a certain point, then I want Ross's expertise to get that animal out to the public.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what people understand is the process at all. Like that there is a process. Then suddenly the meat just shows up on the grocery store shelf. So the fact that someone even called and asked for a cow is, I think, a heck of a good step. You know, like the idea that they could have a cow and it can be cut up and it's just a very different way of approaching of buying meat to begin with. So I would imagine that's rare. How many people are offering?
It used to be more common than it is now. If we go back 30 or 40 years, butchers, there were many more processing plants, and they frequently had freezer lockers. So you would, say, buy a half of a cow, and it would be put in a freezer locker for you. You didn't have to have a freezer at home.
Oh, now that's a good idea.
This was many years ago.
Ross is going to add that to his repertoire.
I'm out of space.
Yeah, it's difficult. Like we say, one cow takes up a lot of space in the cooler. And so as people become more aware of what goes on, we do get inquiries several times a year for this. And we're part of the Carolina Farm Stewardship Tour, the Piedmont Tour, occasionally, from that, someone will want a whole cow, or a family wants a whole cow.
Mm-hmm. We're actually at the point in this program where we want to know where you are. So, Charles, where is your farm?
Braeburn Farm is in Snow Camp, North Carolina. It is it's not hard to find, but it is. It's pretty far out in the boondocks, considering how concentrated where I grew up and part of my life in Montana was 55 miles from town. So we're 12 miles south of Burlington, about 14 miles north of Siler City, about 25 miles west of Chapel Hill, and 25 miles east of Greensboro. And that's where we're located. It's basically referred to as the Piedmont of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And that's not very far.
No, and Ross, your store is in Saxbahaw.
We're in Saxbahaw. And we also, unfortunately, not with Charles Beef, but with Eliza's Pork, we are at the Carborough Farmers Market.
Which we'll talk about, too, where you're going to be coming soon. Yes. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef on 97.9. Welcome back. This is Say Yes to the Chef. My name is Kelly Taylor with my co-host Janice Escott. Today our guests are Dr. Charlie Sidnor of Braeburn Farm and Ross Finn of Left Bank Butchery. I wanted to talk a little bit about we've thrown around the word grass-fed beef, that definition. So can you describe, Ross, do you want to talk about what that means? What does it mean?
We've had a number of customers come in, and I think rightfully so, I've had a bad experience with grass-fed beef. I would say that grain, when you finish an animal in a feedlot, tends to be the great equalizer, and that's of course why the industry likes it. It sort of brings all the animals up to a certain variation, but pretty close to one another. Whereas with grass-fed beef, you can do grass-fed beef really, really poorly. You just simply don't give them anything but grass. And the challenge of raising really high-quality grass-fed beef is how you finish the animal on grass. And that takes really incredible pasture management along with good genetics of the cows. And I'm partial here, but I really do believe that Braeburn is some of the best grass-fed beef anywhere in the Southeast. Because of those pasture management techniques. And what that means is that, you know, just to say grass-fed beef, oh, well, I've had grass-fed beef before and it was tough.
Tough, that's always the thing.
I had it and it was kind of gamey. And it's, you know, it's just such a large brush that, you know, I kind of cringe when I hear people talk about grass-fed beef as a thing, as an entity in and of itself. Of course, it could have been cut very poorly. The butcher in me wants to point that out. But more importantly, I think that, you know, it can be done poorly. And especially in order to get some marbling in there, if that's what you're looking for, you know, you need to do it well. So
how do you finish it then, Charlie? What's the difference?
Well, to get Ross a really high quality animal starts with breed. We raise Red Devon cows. These animals came out of New Zealand a few years ago. But there are good animals in every breed, and I do not want to overemphasize breed. The Angus, the Black Angus, Red Angus, Herefords, all of the what are called British breeds can have excellent beef animals. So first thing I want to emphasize is that tenderness is a genetic trait. It is not a feeding trait.
Oh.
So you could have prime beef that was tough. And you would most people think if I get prime beef, by definition, it is tender. That is not true. So you could get select beef that is quite tender. It just doesn't have the degree of marbling because when USDA grades a piece of meat, they simply look between the 12th and 13th rib at the ribeye and see how much fat they can see, and that determines what the grade is.
For and the whole animal.
The whole animal is graded on that basis. In order to get Ross a good piece of meat, I have some Angus in my herd. I've got some Red Angus in it, and I've got a lot of Red Devon in it. And the animal has to be finished. And what happens so often is that grass-fed beef ends up being a yearling steer that weighs 800 pounds and has been fed on really rough forage. And the animal is, one, not going to taste good. Two, it's not going to be marbled. It's going to be dry. And three, it's going to be tough. If it's not of the right quality breed, so my job is to watch the animal. The animal that I just sent Ross yesterday is actually 3 years old, and I've been watching that animal, and he has now reached a level of finish, meaning that he's filled out and there's enough fat there to give a fat cover to the meat, which is important when it cools down. But in addition, remember that the younger the animal is, the more tender it'll be, but the blander the flavor will be. The older the animal is, the beefier it'll be, but you run into some tenderness problems. Ross and I did a beef dinner not long ago, and the animal that we used for that was a 5-year-old. She was 5 years old, and she weighed about 1,450 pounds, and she had come up open. That is, she didn't breed. And you would say, well, goodness, if you're going to have a 5-year-old animal, isn't it going to be tough? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no, it will not. And I think she was exquisite. We specifically held her.
That was the best beef I've ever had. And everybody who came to that meal walked out of there saying the same thing. I would take a nice 3-, 4-, 5-year-old cow. I mean,
yeah,
that's a dream to me. So,
there's the value proposition here, and so the animal has to be fed to the right level of finish, and then the value is added by Ross.
Finish, you mean how big the animal gets, how much fat they have?
That when you look at the animal, it has to be filled out. You look at the brisket, you look at the rump, you look at the whole picture of the animal, and you can tell that the animal is finished. If you take, say, let's say we took a 1,000-pound steer out of a Holstein herd, that's a 1,000 pounds is not a very big Holstein. That's fairly small. And that animal would not be finished.
Mm.
So, and finishing a Holstein to the same level as, say, an Angus or a Red Devon would be difficult. So that's why we don't use Holsteins. They're wonderful milk cows, but they're not very good beef cows.
They are finished on the grass.
They're finished on the grass, but you have to remember that it has to be the name of the game in nature in general is diversity. I don't want the animal on a monoculture. I want the animal on a wide variety of forages, including forbs and legumes and grasses. If you watch cows, they'll even eat the leaves off of trees. Now, what are they getting from the leaves? I don't know, but I want to put them in an environment in which they have a wide variety of choice. And I let I don't know truly what the animal needs on any given day, but the animal has enough instinct to get the right stuff. And then it's my job to provide a smorgasbord that they pick from and end up being high quality. For instance, if you put an animal 100% on fescue, some people say it has an off taste. Likewise, finishing beef on wheat will sometimes give it an off flavor. So we try very hard not to put them on monocultures, but to put them on pastures that have that diversity.
Which is, you are what you eat. The cow is what he eats, and we are what we eat when we eat the cow.
Absolutely.
Which is the point you're trying to make in the cost of what we're saying to pay for a high-quality animal. Why do you want to pay more for a good quality cut of meat?
Mm-hmm. And there is the whole concept of the biochemistry of what's going on in the cow. The fat profile of a well-finished grass-fed animal is very different from the fat profile of an animal coming out of a feedlot. And most nutritionists, if they looked at that fat profile, would tell you that the grass-fed is much more like elk or venison than the feedlot animal. But then we come to the issue of price, because it takes time, expertise, and resources to produce the animal that Ross is going to sell. And now he has to convince you that it's worth the price.
Oh, great ending.
Great,
we have to
ending.
Finish it there.
Thank you very much to Charles Sidnor and to Ross Flynn for being here today. Please like us on our Facebook page, Yes to the Shop. For more information and to listen to previous podcasts of this program, be sure to visit our website, www.yestothechef.com, where co-host Kelly Taylor, natural chef and instructor, and Janice Escott, Cordon Bleu chef and instructor. Happy cooking, Kelly.
Happy cooking.
And thank you very much for being here, both Charlie and Ross.
Thank you for having us.
Have a tomato, Plato. Here's got your Toradora. Oh, Dora.
Try the bologna, Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Everybody eat.
eats when they come to my house. I'll fix your favorite dishes. Hoping this good food will fill you. Stay in the kitchen alone, work my fingers to the bone.